You're listening to the free version of the Little File Radio podcast. We're glad you are. But folks, we need your help. If you want this show to keep going, you got to give us a little bit of support. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every week. It's a fascinating interview this week. We're doing our Democratic Challenger series that we will continue at least for another couple of weeks, months. And we've got great analysis from Digby. So check it out.
Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm
Head
Sam
to ROF
on today's show. Alex Salmon from the American Prospect will be here to discuss how two kidney dialysis companies are spending big money to protect their profits. And with Congress coming back in session this week, we decided to replay Jeff Hauser from the Revolving Door Project when he was on with us over the summer,
years worth of
discussing why Speaker Pelosi and the Democratic leadership don't seem to be that interested in impeaching Donald Trump. Back from vacation, Heather Digby Parton will be here to help me run down all the headlines from this week. And our candidate spotlight this week will be with educator Jamal Bowman from New York's 16th District. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio available on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. There's also a member show, and you can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio program. You get it commercial-free, and you get access to all of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down a busy week in the news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, my vacation has ended, and thank you for joining me. We're back to the grind. Of course, it's September, post-Labor Day. Things are really going to start to change, at least in terms of the presidential race, the primary on the Democratic side. Congress will be back next week, and we will start to at least get a better sense of whether the Democrats are going to pursue any meaningful oversight. I am not terribly optimistic that we're going to see something vigorous, but I am very excited to be proven wrong with that pessimism. But let's just talk a little bit about something that has been, you know, sort of the hallmark of the Trump administration since really day one. In fact, probably since before day one with the inauguration ceremony itself. There's still a lot of questions as to like where money went. Why did they raise so much? But we're seeing with Mike Pence heading over to Ireland, it's right in front of our faces. I saw an amazing question that was asked from, I think it was from Robert Costas of The Washington Post, who asked him like, you know, well, what do you make of people who are complaining that you are staying at a Trump property in Ireland, basically paying the president? So you're flying there on tax dollars. You're paying the president with tax dollars. What do you make of that? And he gave like a 4-minute answer that basically didn't respond to any of that. I know you have a theory about why this is ramping up. Where else is it ramping up and why do you think it is?
Well, I think it's ramping up because for whatever reason, I mean, Trump's been doing this from the beginning, right? I think he spent something like 270 days of his presidency, nearly a third of it, at Trump-branded properties, playing golf or otherwise staying there. And, of course, bringing with it the Secret Service entourage and plenty of publicity, too. You know, I mean, he's pictured being there. They talk about it, the names of these places. Are bandied about all over the news. So he gets a lot of free publicity out of that, and he basically does personal appearances like Kim Kardashian does, you know, in Vegas or whatever, at his properties every weekend. So he's been doing this all along, but there does seem to be some kind of an escalation, and I look specifically at the thing he did at the G7. Which was really only, I think, a little over a week ago. It's hard to believe, but it wasn't that long ago. And he announced there, which, I mean, the G7 was a debacle, of course. I mean, he was a complete mess, and they basically were just ignoring him. But he got up at the end of the session and gave what ended up being a half-hour long infomercial about his golf course in the Doral golf course in Florida, and saying that he was going, the United States is hosting the next G7, and they had decided that this was really the only place they could possibly hold it. And he went into a big long spiel about how it was beautiful bungalows and it has great Wi-Fi. And this, you know, I mean, it's really, really the only place they could hold it. And everybody agreed, of course, he says, that the Secret Service and everybody in the government agreed this is really the only thing to do. Well, I mean, this is outrageous. I mean, not only is that a case of taxpayers spending money on a Trump property, but this would be, you know, foreign countries spending a bunch of money on Trump property. And it was quite clear. And when you know, they went and looked at the status of Doral, Doral is a major money-losing property for Trump. It's clear that he's trying to drum up business at his property there by doing the infomercial and potentially actually holding the G7 there, although I have my doubts this is going to happen. And it occurred to me, after it was also reported that he was, you know, talking an awful lot about interest rates recently and really being, you know, pushing hard, they've got to lower interest rates, and what's wrong? He called Jerome Powell, the head of the Fed, you know, said he wasn't, asked rhetorically if he was as much of an enemy as the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. Very, very angry because, as you know, during our break, the stock market was wild and lost 800 points in one day, and things were going crazy because of the trade war, and Trump was blaming it on interest rates. But it was also pointed out that he stands, if they get those interest rates lowered, he stands to save millions of dollars in interest on outstanding loans on his hotels and resorts. So there's all this kind of stuff that's kind of adding up, and I don't know if it's just that the press is paying more attention. You and I've talked about this endlessly over the past couple of years, but I also think that maybe Trump, somewhere in the back of his mind, is hedging his bets on 2020 and starting to realize that he needs to do whatever he can as president to boost his business, which would include, you know, something like interest rates for sure, as well as boosting his properties just in case it doesn't work out. I mean, some, you know, this is the guy who, you know, said that he had the Russia deal, Trump Tower Moscow, going because he wasn't sure he was going to win. So why should he give up that opportunity? So I know that he thinks that way, you know, kind of thinking both sides of any issue like that. And, of course, he denies it. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see a lot more of this over the next year. This level of just sort of overt graft and corruption has been there from the beginning. But it really, I mean, he's being much more open about it than he even was before. That thing with Doral was, I think it kind of shocked even people who follow him, follow that beat, kind of like, wow, he's really going for it. So anyway, that's my theory. I don't know. Maybe he's just, you know, maybe Eric and Don just came to him and said, hey, Dad, you know, we're really in trouble here. You know, would you mind giving us a little boost? I don't know. But something seems to be changing. And I've seen very little evidence so far that the Democrats are focusing on this, which I think is probably a big mistake.
Yeah, I mean, that's a second, like, sort of sidebar to this, is the way the Democrats react to this stuff. But I did. It's funny that you say that, because I did see, I think just a day or two ago, a report that says the Doral is just cratering in terms of its market share or whatever it is, mm-hmm. or the business is doing, because, of course, Donald Trump is a toxic brand right now. So your speculation is that he's just contemplating life after the presidency and starting to realize, like, I need to monetize this as soon as possible. And I will also say, you know, we see images of him playing 36 holes of golf or 48 holes of golf or whatever it is, as Dorian is, you know, bearing down on countries. Supposedly he stayed home from the Irish trip for that very reason. And you forget that it's not just that he's playing golf when he should be working. It's that he's making money for himself by playing golf when he should be working, and for his whole family. I mean, this is basically, he's got this massive government contract that is just paying for his, you know, for the security and all the upgrades, probably the infrastructure upgrades at these places. It's it's sort of astonishing. And it is sort of astonishing that you don't have the Democrats making more of an issue of it. All right, look, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we got a lot more to talk about. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Digby will join me in a minute. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Digby. So, Heather, in the last segment, we were talking about what you've noticed that there has been a bit of an uptick on Donald Trump attempting basically to monetize the presidency. And we see it in the context of his properties. We see it in that, you know, I mean, if your theory is correct, then just having putting Mike Pence out there, having to answer all the awkward questions of like, hey, wait a second, should you really be staying at a Trump property? Isn't that sort of a conflict of interest? Why are taxpayers paying money to the president for owning real estate? I imagine if your theory is correct, we will see even more of this, and it will start to take, you know, maybe we'll start hearing a little bit more about Trump TV. I mean, I wonder if his attacks on Fox aren't, having a dual purpose. One being he wants more and better, I guess, coverage from Fox News. But he could also be setting up like, hey, Fox deserted me. They deserted you. Come on over to Trump TV. In the event that he loses the election.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I wrote a piece about that this week, about his, feud with Fox, and that was part of it. I mean, I actually did say that going back to the point where, back to the 2016 campaign, Roger Ailes, you know, was back Trump from the beginning. He always knew that Trump had some kind of, special juju with the conservatives, and he'd be able to win. But Roger Ailes was forced out of Fox, if you recall, during the campaign for his egregious sexual harassment. And he and Trump were rumored at that time, and I remember writing about it back in the campaign, to be putting together some kind of Trump TV. That was part of the plan in 2016. Again, sort of, Trump looking a little bit ahead to see what – and there was some discussion of whether or not he might buy OAN, which he promotes all the time now as the alternative to Fox. So this would not surprise me at all if this is another one of those situations where Trump is just kind of, setting things in motion in case he loses the election in 2020. I would totally believe that he's doing that. And look, as far as, monetizing, I mean, look at this one really got me. We didn't mention this in the previous segment, but, the Attorney General of the United States booked a party at the Trump Hotel for $30,000, and it's not taxpayer money, it's personal money. I mean, it's as if he's putting money into the president's pocket, his own that's against the rules. I think the rule at the Department of Justice is that you can't give a gift to your boss that's worth more than $25. But they've determined this isn't really that, and so, the Attorney General of the United States, I mean, he's making a statement, obviously. There's just no doubt about it, of course. This is Bill Barr playing politics. He's a very cunning right-wing partisan, we have discovered.
He's also
really
the guy that wrote that 18-page memo to Donald Trump about why he could not be obstructing justice as president.
Right. I mean, this is a guy, I mean, we know, I mean, and we should have known from the very beginning. I was much too willing to give the benefit of the doubt, something that I'm no longer giving even to the inspector general or any of the other people in this whole story, because something's really rotten about the way that they have approached Donald Trump, particularly under Bill Barr. But in any case, not to digress too much, this whole idea about Trump and Fox News and all that. I mean, he's going against the very, the foundation of what Fox was founded on, which was a pretense that it was a news organization.
Right.
That was always supposed to be there. And Trump is out there saying, you're not there for me anymore. You are betraying me. You're not good for us, I think. Even getting Britt Hume, his, most slavishly devoted fanboy over there at Fox in the news division, to, step and say, we don't work for you, Mr. President, which is kind of funny because, of course, in some respect they do. But nonetheless, he's broken the pretense that they are a news organization. And I think that is interesting, and that it may very well be that he is setting up a choice. Look, you're either with me or you're with Fox, and to see how many, and a lot of those people who are big Trump fans are also Fox fans. So it should be an interesting thing.
Well, remember, he did this with, I can't remember her name now, who went on to NBC. Megyn Kelly. I mean, so there's a precedent for this entire thing. Mm-hmm. And I should just say that I think, I can't tell you how much I regret that I know this, but it was Neil Cavuto who said that, not Britt Hume, who said that we don't talk for you. He is the wormy toady of Donald Trump. But that, I mean, it's fascinating to see this lineup. And then the question, of course, is, and we just got about a minute left to discuss, is will the Democrats start to dig into this stuff? I mean, my sense is that they don't feel there's any hay to be made here, which I don't know. I think that's just foolishly short-sighted that, and it's a misunderstanding of what the electorate is. And maybe this is something we can talk about in the next hour a bit, because the Democrats' failure to stay dogged on Trump, I think, is a grave miscalculation on their part. And I think it, in some ways, it dovetails into what we've seen in the presidential election, where, Joe Biden feels his job is basically to convince never Trump or Republicans to come vote for Democrats by making Democrats as least offensive as they possibly can to those Republican voters who will never vote for a Democrat if it's not Donald Trump on the ticket, and maybe may not even do so in this instance. But Digby, let's take a quick break. When we come back in the next hour, if you will join me, we will talk about these Democrats and also a majorly important case in North Carolina that could really affect that state for decades to come. We got to take a quick break. Be right back. Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, an unbelievable story that involves two dialysis companies and how they protect their monopoly and profits. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours pouring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Two major companies control 70% of our country's kidney dialysis care, and they're making billions of dollars in profits from it. Lately, bills such as AB 290 in California have been proposed to limit reimbursement from private insurance companies, which has led to millions of dollars in lobbying efforts to protect those profits. Here to explain the dialysis duopoly, Alex Salmon from the American Prospect. So, Alex, let's start with AB 290, because I got to say, I'm glad this piece of legislation, frankly, well, I'm glad it exists. I don't want to say that I'm glad it's in jeopardy, but I'm glad it exists because your piece in the American Prospect on the dialysis duopoly is fascinating. I didn't know any of this stuff. Let's start with AB 290, but maybe even before we do that, give us a sense of how many people in this country are on dialysis. And I assume that many people know what it is, but it basically deals with kidney failure.
Yeah, that's correct. It's a medical treatment that that people undergo and their kidneys are unable to filter blood appropriately or effectively. And there's something like 500,000 people in the United States who undergo some form of dialysis treatment every year.
And we should say that what that involves is once a week, maybe twice a week, going to a dialysis clinic of some sorts. And it takes a couple hours at least, I think. And you basically wash your blood.
Yeah, that's correct. It's time and labor intensive. It's very expensive, and it's very exhausting for the people who go through it too. So it's oftentimes people who are going through these treatments multiple times a week. They can't maintain the sort of steady job or the kind of exhaustive labor that other people do. So it's a serious procedure.
And it's one that's ongoing. My understanding is that once you are basically are in need of dialysis because you've had some type of kidney failure, sometimes people lose a kidney to you only need one. But if that one fails, then you need to go to dialysis. You're right. There are two companies that dominate the American outpatient kidney dialysis market. Tell us about those two companies.
Yeah, so there's two big players. One is called DaVita, which is a company based out of Denver. The other one is called Fresenius, and that's a German-owned company. And between the two of them, they control some 70% of the dialysis outpatient dialysis market. So they're the two kind of heavy hitters, and they've cornered this market in a pretty astonishing way.
How long have they been in operation? I mean, how long has this dynamic been in place with just two major players?
I'm not sure exactly. It's like so many things. It's something that has gotten more acute over recent years. I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but it's something that kind of has emerged in recent years. I think that they've gotten more entrenched in this position, and so now yeah, you got these two companies that pretty much rule the roost, and there are some other smaller players, but yeah, they're definitely the two top dogs.
Give us a sense of how much money they make annually on, you know, I guess if it's 75%, I'm trying to do the math, 500,000 people. You know, they're servicing, I don't know, 350,000, 400,000 of people annually. How much money are they making from these dialysis? Like, what are their what are their revenues?
Yeah, the two companies combined taking about $4 billion in annual profits. So it's a pretty healthy business for them. They make a pretty good chunk of change.
That wait, is that profits or just revenue?
That's profits, yeah.
Wow. Okay. So they do quite well for themselves. And so now they have spent $2.5 million, you write, into a lobbying operation to oppose a single bill in the California State House. What is that bill?
Yeah, sure. So the bill is AB 290. It's currently sitting in the California State Senate, and it's a bill that would effectively cap some of their billing processes. It would basically cap the rate at which kidney dialysis is billed to and peg it to the rate at which Medicare is billed. So right now the bulk of kidney dialysis recipients are on Medicare, and Medicare, because of that broad user base, can negotiate a lower rate. And so these two companies make a very limited amount, or, you know, some of them, sometimes they claim to lose money off of a Medicare patient, but if a patient comes in on private insurance, they can actually bill at something like four times as much for the same procedure, for the same treatment. So the bulk of their money is coming from, in fact, one estimation that they put forward in at the JP Morgan Healthcare Conference in 2018 said that something like 110% of their profits are coming from people with private insurance who come through for treatment, and they get that treatment billed at a rate that's four times what Medicare bills at. And this bill, kind of in short, would cap some of their some of that more egregious sort of billing processes and pay it to the Medicare rate.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit here. And what does that mean, 110%? 110% of what? What is that?
Yeah, 110% of their profits, according to this presentation that they put forward. They claim that 90% of I think 90% of their patients are coming through on Medicare, and on those they are losing money. But on the 10% that come through on private insurance, they're making 115% of their profits. So they're both overcoming those losses and racking up that, you know, that combined $4 billion a year that they take home in profits.
Wow. Okay. And now the question as to whether they are losing money on Medicare is in dispute. Supposedly, you report that the president of at least one of those companies said, yeah, we make money on Medicare patients. But before we get there, that all these patients are on Medicare or could be, how did that happen? Are all these people over the age of 65?
It's an interesting arrangement. Yeah. So the kidney is the single part of the body that is covered by single payer in this country, and it's a very particular arrangement. But because kidney dialysis is so expensive, it's, you know, both time and money intensive. The federal government passed a provision in 1972 that said that every person in this country who goes through kidney dialysis will be covered under Medicare. So it's kind of it's the seed of a single payer system here. It just is only for one body part, and that is applied no matter what your age is or what your income is or any of that.
That's fascinating. What is the, I mean, I imagine, I don't know if you had time to go back and look at like the legislative history, but why, how did it get to be just dialysis as opposed to, I don't know, heart arrhythmia or something?
Yeah, I think it's just a byproduct of how expensive that procedure is, or how expensive that treatment is. And I think, you know, if in the days before the Affordable Care Act, you know, those 500,000 people would have been ineligible for private insurance because that's a massive pre-existing condition, right? And so it became one of those things where, you know, for almost everyone, that would be cost prohibitive and they would be unable to pay for it themselves. And rather than having a massive, you know, public health crisis where people with kidney failure were unable to acquire the care they need, I think the federal government basically provisioned for this just out of sheer necessity if, based on cost alone.
That's fascinating. And we should say, obviously, that was during a Republican presidency, a different era, perhaps. All right. Well, let's take a break here. So where we're at this point is you have told us that the dialysis industry in this country is dominated by two players. They own 70% essentially of the business in this country, that Medicare has been covering dialysis patients regardless of age for 50 years. But, and here's the twist, there is a mechanism in which to drive people to private insurance. That this legislation being considered now in California, AB 290, would essentially blow up. When we come back, folks are not going to believe how people are being driven into private insurance by these two companies, which basically own the dialysis business in this country. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back. Ring of Fire Radio.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with the American Prospect's Alex Salmon about his piece, "The Dialysis Duopoly Spends Big to Protect Profits in California." So, Alex, let me just reset just briefly. You told us in the last segment about these two companies that control 70% of the dialysis business in this country. They are pushing people into private insurance because the Medicare reimbursement rates is about $250 for every dialysis session. And private insurances can be up to four times that amount, $1,000. So this AB 290 that is being proposed in the California legislature that they are spending millions of dollars to prevent from passing, what does that AB 290 say specifically?
Well, what it says is basically that that the reimbursement rate for private insurance would be pegged to the Medicare rate. So the kind of price gouging that you're seeing with that $1,000 treatment cost would be pegged to something a little bit more, like the Medicare cost, which is $250, as you mentioned, and it prevents this arrangement where these institutions that are funded by the dialysis companies encourage patients to leave their Medicare and get on private insurance, which kind of facilitates this whole scheme from the outset.
So I want to be explicit with this because this story is amazing. These two companies fund like what I think you could call is a charity, right? It's like the American Kidney Foundation. And it sounds like, you know, the American Cancer Association or something like that. And this American Kidney Foundation seems to be basically a pass through where the companies get a tax break for contributing to them. And then they subsidize private insurance. So maybe they'll pay, I don't know, $200 of the insurance cost. The insurance cost may cost, I don't know, $1,200. But that $1,200, that other $1,000 that the patient lays out, ends up generating thousands of dollars of profit for the companies. Is that right?
More or less, yeah. So the American Kidney Fund will encourage patients who are covered on Medicare to leave that Medicare coverage for private insurance, and the sweetener for them is, or for the patients, is the fund basically covers the premiums. They pay the insurance premiums, so there's no individual expenditure for the patient that is any more significant than what they'd be paying on Medicare. But when they come through the door with that private insurance, then it's the dialysis outpatient centers that then get to bill at that sweetheart rate. So it's not something that extorts the patient so much as it basically bilks the insurance companies. And the issue with that is then, you know, when the insurance companies incur higher costs, they're not just eating that. They're passing that on to every other person who has insurance, and that, you know, leads to higher premiums and that other cost-related health issues down the line.
So if I'm a patient who is covered by Medicare for dialysis, and the American Kidney Fund comes to me and they say, you can get private insurance cost-free to cover this. Why do I do that? Do I do that because that private insurance is going to cover a bunch of other stuff, including my dialysis? Or is it just that I am been trained by the market to believe that for some reason private insurance is going to get me better coverage than Medicare?
It's an interesting sales pitch. Yeah, I'm having not gone through it, I'm not sure exactly what the clincher is. But I think generally speaking, what is being told to these patients is that they're going to get the same treatment that they get on Medicare, right? It's the same dialysis treatment that they'd be otherwise getting. It's at no extra special cost to them. Their personal expenditure remains the same. And, you know, perhaps down the road, you know, something will happen where it will behoove them to have private insurance. And, you know, whether or not that's the case, it's hard to know, but that's basically the sales pitch. There's the downside is minimal, and the upside is unknown. So, you know, why not?
Right. It doesn't cost me anything. I might as well get that coverage. Medicare will still be there if something goes south here with this. So essentially, the numbers, if I understand it from reading your piece, the companies donate $250 million, is it, to this American Kidney Fund? How much of American Kidney Fund's operating expenses or their endowment, how much of that is a function of that $250 million that they get annually from these two dialysis companies?
It's about 80%. So the roughly $250 million that is contributed by these two companies as charitable donations represents about 80% of the fund's total donor base. And so it's a significant percentage.
I mean, this is, and so they fund the fund. The fund then buys insurance for all of these patients, and then they get reimbursed when they go for dialysis. 80% of them are going to end up going to these private companies. Does the fund sort of weed out? Do they focus on areas where these two companies operate?
There's been some reports. The New York Times has done some reporting on this, and there have been lawsuits alleging certain things that there may be favorable treatment towards those two companies. It's something that I haven't gotten into personally, or haven't looked at that closely, but it's definitely an element of it. There have been whispers for a long time that would be the case. That is the case, and obviously it's. Wouldn't be something that would be impossible to believe, but it's, it's an ongoing, I think there are ongoing investigations into whether or not that's the case.
So, these two companies, they put $250 million into this fund, the fund buys insurance, and then it kicks off profits of billions of dollars annually for, these companies. That is an amazing, I'm sorry, it's a scam. I mean, that's essentially some type of kickback, scheme, essentially. I mean, on some level, and in the end, it's all the people who buy insurance who are getting saddled with this bill when, in fact, it could be a Medicare picking up this coverage at a much cheaper price. So I understand why they're fighting this. This is a big, you're right that this is a big caveat, too, for single payer, because we're going to see, like, these companies will game the system any way they can.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. And you know, they've gotten over the last handful of years, have gotten used to some pretty remarkable profits. And yeah, it's one of these things where there is a reason healthcare is so expensive in the United States, why it, you know, far surpasses peer countries in terms of cost. And this is just one very small example of that, in the ways in which these procedures can be gamed and these operations can be gamed to extract massive profits. And it's something that I think, you know, we'll start seeing on a larger scale the more the debate over single payer advances in you know, the national arena. Well, you know, this is certainly not a unique situation.
Well, that's sort of amazing to contemplate. I mean, there's so much waste in this system. And by waste, I just mean this is profiteering. I mean, this is just a scam that's set up so that these guys can profit more on the same procedure that they're getting lower reimbursement rates on. It has nothing to do with the quality of the care for the patients. This is why our healthcare costs so much, because essentially you have a whole network, it feels like, of providers and insurers who are just basically milking the taxpayer or just the patients. Alex, fascinating piece. Thanks so much for coming on and talking about it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Alex Salmon is a staff writer for the American Prospect. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you're missing.
I've always done the best I could to get out of my neighborhood. Growing up, I spilled my blood, but you're still my home. You stay within my bones. Setting out on the highest wall.
Hey, folks. It's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.